Good afternoon, and welcome back. Here we go. Welcome back to We the People. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And we've had sort of a odd beginning there on our first hour, but I really do hope you go back and at least listen to the back half of the first hour. We started early with our guest, Myron Magnet. He was supposed to be second hour, but we pulled a hostage maneuver and got him on early. And have a couple fun videos for you online that it'll just make you happy. You can't have too much of that. So we're discussing Clarence Thomas today, and what were we talking about on the break, Bill? You had made some comment, and I said, let's ask him about it.
Oh.
He ate peanuts, I ate a banana, came back in here. Oh, we're the worst.
Well, we were talking about...
Before the break, so we were talking about Clarence Thomas's biography.
Yeah.
Right, right.
And as I recount in Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution, he went through this real black radical phase.
That was what we were thinking about. Like every other kid goes to college and kind of goes off the rails a little bit.
Yeah, and he said, he said, I was a black radical. He said, then I grew up. of course, what's interesting is that he kind of had to think his way to conservatism, and he did it in a funny way. I mean, first he took the kind of black separatism, black self-help strand in Malcolm X, and he would talk about that a lot because he didn't want his friends to know that he was actually moving to the right. Then he got to Yale Law School, and, you know, he was hearing about all the discrimination there, but he said, well, just, you know, wait. He was seeing that affirmative action that was really underway at that time was not doing anybody, was not doing its supposed beneficiaries any good, because all these smart black kids would be admitted to the Yale Law School, but it would be a school that would be a rank or two above where their preparation should have put them. And so had they gone to, you know, the state law school, say, they would have succeeded brilliantly, but here, up against the smartest kids in the country, and the kids who'd been to, you know, Newton and Brookline high schools and to private school, they weren't cutting it. So as they were failing, they would be resentful. Of course, you know, if you have a choice between blaming yourself and blaming the system, it's easier to blame the system. And that's what they would do. So instead of having the desired effect of creating this new class of well-educated, highly motivated black leaders, it was taking the people who would have formed that class and turning them into resentful failures. As to those who succeeded, like Thomas, what he discovered when he got out of Yale Law School, I mean, I can hear his voice when he says, I couldn't get a job. I couldn't get a job. Because everybody assumed that, oh, here's a black graduate of the Yale Law School, he must be a dummy. He must have got through only on account of affirmative action, which was certainly not true in his case.
How was he able to get into Yale?
Well, he got into Yale partly on affirmative action, but he would have got into Yale any which way, because he was a cum laude graduate of Holy Cross College. He was a really excellent undergraduate student. But, you know, he also got in because there was this affirmative action program way. So he got a boost. And, you know, if you were to ask him this question, he wouldn't be able to answer it, you know. If you were to say, Mr. Justice, did you get into Yale on your own merits or because of affirmative action, he would be embarrassed to give you the answer. And that's part of the problem with affirmative action, right. He would tell you. You don't know. You don't know what you have actually achieved on your own, and therefore you can't take confidence in the accomplishment, and that is really subversive to your ability to function in the world. So he said, you know, he wanted a regular corporate law firm job, and all they were offering him were, you know, pro bono type jobs where he's gonna work with the poor and the disadvantaged. And so finally he got a job working in the Attorney General's office of Missouri. And he said, I don't want to work on any race stuff. He said, I just put me in criminal law. And so he learned a lot there. He said he'd gone to this riot in Harvard Square in support of the black political prisoners, the imprisoned Black Panthers. Well, I mean, what he learned is that all these supposed black political prisoners weren't black political prisoners at all. He had a case of some guy who held a blade to a black woman's throat to rape it to a black woman's child's throat so that he could rape and sodomize the mother, who was afraid for her kid's life. He said, this is not a victim. This is not a political prisoner. This is just a plain, flat-out thug, evil thug. And he came to learn that the reason that there are more blacks in prison, that there's a disproportional number of blacks in prison, is because guess what? Blacks commit crimes at a disproportionate rate. And guess who their victims are? Disproportionately other blacks. And that's one of the things that makes black inner cities so difficult to succeed in, because kids are scared to go to school because the streets are infested with thugs. And once they're in school, there's no order in the school because guess what? The Supreme Court has taken the authority to discipline away from teachers and principals. And then you get to your housing project and it's a pandemonium. You can't study because, once again, the Supreme Court has taken away the right of the housing authorities to keep order there. This practical experience taught him an awful lot about how the world really is. And the Attorney General, and forgive me, I'm blanking on the name here, became elected senator and went to Washington and took Thomas with him. And so Thomas was now a Republican senatorial staffer and got invited to a meeting of young black leaders organized by the great economist Thomas Sowell out in California. And by now, Thomas had been reading Sowell's collected works becoming increasingly convinced that the way of black success was not to organize politically and force the government to give more welfare, to decriminalize crime, to, you know, forcibly desegregate schools by busing, to have affirmative action. It was for blacks to go out into the private economy and make their own successes and then be accepted by the larger society in the terms that society understands, which is accomplishment, success, merit. And there was no reason why blacks couldn't do that at all. So he's at this conference and he's just chatting to one of the fellow audience members, and he's talking about how he really objects to welfare because when his mother moved to Savannah, she took him and his little brother with her, but she left their older sister behind in the Georgia swamp community with their relatives. And so his family is a kind of natural experiment in what upbringing does. So there's Thomas and his little brother, who grew up in, you know, an intact two adult family, even though they were his grandparents, not his parents. Whereas his sister grows up sort of from pillar to post and ends up on welfare. And he's saying, you know, and you can't, he's saying to his seatmate at this conference, you can't believe how dependent she is. If the mailman is a day late with her check, she gets angry. That's how totally dependent she is, and her kids are getting like that. Well, his seatmate turned out to be Juan Williams, the reporter for the Washington Post, who the next day publishes a profile of Clarence Thomas in the Washington Post, which brings him to the attention of the Reagan administration, who put him first in the Civil Rights Division of the Education Department.
Was it a fair? Was it a fair profile? I mean, was it
very
accurate?
Fair? Yeah. Very accurate, but I mean, you know, what he said about his sister was just, you know, like a bombshell, and I mean, nobody in his family was talking to him for a while after that, and other black people were saying, how could you be so insensitive to say such a thing as that? You know, it's like wearing aggressive perfume. It's
and it was like waving a banner or something.
Yeah, and then he ends up being the head of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. So you know, now he's studying, wait a minute, how come blacks aren't getting ahead, right? I mean, his job is to make sure that blacks get equal employment opportunity.
Right, so he's getting ready to say a lot of things that are not going to be popular that, you know.
Yeah, you
have to take a we have to take a really quick break, but honestly, it's really unfortunate. He, I don't know, didn't have more clout or something, and then we could stop having this conversation, but it'll probably never end.
Well,
I guess.
He's got clout. He's
I know. I mean, it's just
Supreme Court justice. That's going to be our punchline there.
It's just too bad he can't make some sort of a vaccine or something.
He's doing it.
Oh, man. All right, we'll be right back. Our guest is Myron Magnet. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Oh, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Whoa, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy, mercy.
Oh, if you're tired of the same old story, oh, baby, turn some pages.
Yeah, if only we could make people understand what Clarence Thomas figured out a long time ago.
Well, we're working on it. Tell everybody to buy Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution. That'll be a good start.
But you know, he is who he is because of his upbringing and the perspective he had on life.
And instead of making it making him a victim and a weakling and demand that everybody else become a victim and a weakling because somehow that was going to make everybody better.
Equal.
He said, hey, wait a second.
But this is now a whole governmental philosophy. He says,
right.
You know, we've come to the point, and this brings us back to your democratic socialists, you know.
With their
limp wrists. I mean,
mm-hmm.
He's saying, look, it's certainly black radicals who want government to remake society for their benefit, but not just black radicals, but now everybody on the left seems to feel that government exists to remove adversity from life. He says, this is a fundamental misconception of the human condition. Everybody, and this is not just black people, but all people, face some kind of adversity or other, at least at some point in their lives. And what you have to do is be able to look at the adversity and say, okay, I can grapple with this and try to master it, and be the captain of my soul and overcome, right? I will overcome. This makes you a much stronger person, gives you the self-confidence to take on the next challenge, and the kind of inner grit, to say, wait a minute, I'm going to be responsible for myself. And he said, you want to know what? The dirty little secret of freedom is that you are crossing the prairie of life at your own risk and all by yourself. And you have to do it. You have to take responsibility for it and be ready to face the obstacles that will come along. And he said that a politics that is based on the idea that government can somehow remove all these bumps on the trail of life is delusional. No government has the capacity to do that. It does not have the capacity to do it for black people. And as your democratic socialist friends having their convention right now will discover, it does not have the power to do it for any people. We know the way that finally ends up with some kind of Jacobin with his guillotine, or some kind of Lenin.
Oh yeah, it always turns out that way. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it always does. But there's, you know, so this kind of charade that's going on up there in Sacramento right now is just the exact opposite of what American culture needs. We need people who say, hey, we have a free country here with all its, with by the way, it's rather few faults. And by the way, we have spent the last 60 years at least, you know, the center of our politics has been to try to make up for and undo all of the residue of 200 years of slavery and 100 years of Jim Crow. And certainly we have gone too far in many respects in this effort, but heaven knows the intention of, you know, mainstream American politics has been to atone for and correct this founding blemish in American society. Well, you know what? White society has now done everything it can possibly do to atone for slavery and Jim Crow. And what Clarence Thomas would say is, you know, it's now up to us black people, and we have to move off the dime on this.
So you're thinking he's probably not behind the reparations movement?
Well, I mean, it's so interesting to look at his jurisprudence through the lens of race, because he's written this, you know, written these very powerful anti-affirmative action opinions, saying, "Come on, you know, who is benefiting here? Who is benefiting from turning people who would succeed into resentful failures? The only people who are benefiting are the white college administrators who can feel that they're virtuous because they've got their quotas." And he says, and by the way, who is benefiting from these Supreme Court decisions that resulted in striking down vagrancy and loitering laws that has depoliced inner cities? Who has benefited but criminals, and who suffers from them are the good majority of inner city communities who are principally black and Hispanic people. And you're going to make them pay to make you feel good because you're saying, oh, these poor criminals, they're really victims of an unjust system. And who is benefiting from taking away the traditional authority of teachers and principals who were always understood to be in loco parentis? There were no due process rights for pupils in grammar schools and high schools.
Not in my school.
And so who is benefiting from turning these schools into anarchies? So, you know, here the taxpayers of America are shelling out, you know, in where I live in New York, we're shelling out $20,000 a year per kid in the public schools to get this D-minus education in which few kids graduate and few of those who graduate actually are literate and employable. What have we actually done here by making the object of our school system for the last 50 years be to make racial equality and to make the world safe for juvenile delinquents? We have turned everything upside down. So, I mean, he's got a whole bunch of opinions that are saying, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. Who do we benefit by Supreme Court decisions that, in effect, nullify the Bill of Rights so that the government of New London, Connecticut, for example, can take away your house and give it to somebody else who's going to make a higher value use of the property in order to raise the tax base of New London and do what with it? Well, raise the salaries and pensions of the politicians who are overseeing all of this. I mean, there's, you know, so that's a real kind of tyranny, which he sees. And he says, by the way, I grew up under state-sanctioned segregation, and that's as close to totalitarianism as I would like to get. So he does recognize totalitarianism, and he does recognize with it when the government says, oh, I am here to do this good thing for you, you can end up having tyranny. That's why we have, at least for starters, there are four 2015 opinions of his attacking
the basis. Would you be okay to sketch those for us when we come back?
Yeah, I will.
That would be awesome. And I found a song. I should have played it earlier for you fellas. This goes out to all those men with their little red bandanas at the Democratic Socialist Convention that we highlighted earlier. You can see the video on our website at wethepeopleradio.us. Here you go. It's official. We have dance moves for radio. But we were killing it there for like 30 seconds. So we were
talking about the four opinions.
But I want to know, before we do that, though, I want to know why. I mean, is it just me and I'm not paying attention? Or are his opinions and ideas kind of swept under the rug a little bit? Is there a reason that he's not more prominently figured and we don't hear more?
Oh, yeah, he's totally out of the mainstream. I mean, this is not what the Yale and Law School, the Yale and Harvard Law Schools teach. This is what the Founding Fathers taught. And so he's resuscitating them. You know, one of the arguments I make in Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution is that part of the or at the center of the anger that we see in American political discourse right now is that we're living under two different constitutions. There, guys like us believe in the Constitution of Freedom. We are the Freedom Party, and we believe in a Constitution that that keeps the world safe for freedom and requires self-reliance. And then there's the Fairness Party that believes in the living Constitution, and that's kind of what, you know, this is what all the elites believe in right now. It started with Woodrow Wilson, who really despised the Founding Fathers, despised the framers, thought the Constitution was this silly, antique, obsolete document. He says, we've passed the age of constitutionalism, we're in the age of administration, and that what we need is a fast-moving Darwinian government that adapts to changing times instantly, the way to do that is to be governed by a bunch of Ivy League-trained experts, supposedly apolitical, like Mr. Comey, in working in administrative agencies, in order to, do expert things to tell us how to live. Well, this is not self-government, for sure. This is Frederick the Great's government by enlightened bureaucrats. But the thing about enlightened despotism is that the Enlightenment evaporates, leaving only the despotism behind. So, but Woodrow Wilson's vision prevailed and was supersized by the New Deal. And Franklin Roosevelt then created all these administrative agencies, which he confessed, he admitted, were a fourth branch of government that had no foundation in the Constitution whatsoever. But you remember, he threatened the Supreme Court that he was going to enlarge it and pack it with new dealers if they didn't go along with this stuff, if they didn't let him use the Commerce Clause of Article 1 of the Constitution to take control of the entire American economy, which was the program of the New Deal. And the Supreme Court, and it was a justice named Roberts who folded on this one, said, okay, you got us. We're going along with it. And so the Supreme Court just crumbled and did not live up to its oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So we got this giant administrative state from the SEC to the FEC to the National Labor Relations Board and on and on and on through the whole alphabet of these whippersnapper lawyers, unelected by anybody, making laws like a legislature, carrying them out like an executive, and adjudicating and punishing infractions of them like a judiciary. This is the administrative state, and we've still got it. And they're still telling us what to do through the Environmental Protection Agency. You know the story of that guy in Colorado who dug two ponds to protect himself in case forest fires broke out. He needed a reservoir to pump out of to fight forest fires. The EPA charges him with polluting the navigable waterways of the United States, the nearest one of which is 40 miles away. And the guy ends up paying a $130,000 fine. This is just a rancher paying a $130,000 fine and being sentenced to prison for 18 months. Now, if you want to know what hokey Star Chamber, quote, justice this is, you will notice that the Trump administration rescinded this regulation just last week. So here's this guy with his $130,000 fine and his 18-month prison sentence. He's dead now, so there's nothing you can do about it, right? But the EPA just rescinded the rule. It's like this is not self-government, not self-government at all. But so even Clarence Thomas looks out on this, and he says, fellas, this has to stop, right? The Supreme Court was asleep at the switch, or chicken, when we let the administration of Franklin Roosevelt and then all subsequent administrations do this. We were wrong, and one of the things that makes Thomas such a judicial outlier is he says, and you know what, my fellow justices, you believe in the doctrine of stare decisis, the doctrine that once we make a decision, that's the law, and you have to abide by it. It is settled law. He said, okay, that's the unwritten British Constitution that the colonists lived under for 150 years before they decided they didn't want to live under that because you didn't have freedom under it. They wanted a written constitution whose meaning does not change, and so that's why we had it. And he said, and by the way, even the English recognized that judges can make mistakes, so they have no problem in a judge saying, hey, we're going to correct the error of our predecessors here and change this ruling. He says the Supreme Court has to do it now. So if the Supreme Court has made a mistake, and by the way, we're only human, and we have made mistakes in the past, and some of them have been real doozies, we have to overrule these. We have to overturn them and go back to that Constitution of Liberty that the framers gave us. And this is where Thomas is getting real traction now. He has, in Gorsuch especially, and Kavanaugh to some degree, and Roberts when he's being Chief Justice Jekyll rather than Chief Justice Hyde, he has colleagues who are going along on this, so they actually have been overturning precedents in this last term.
Have they overturned Supreme Court decisions, though?
They have overturned Supreme Court decisions. Yes, Bill, they have.
Okay.
And you can do that. That is okay. And, of course, this is what has the left shivering in its shoes.
Yeah, I was going to say, they're in the panic.
Oh, my God, how you're going to overturn settled law? This is what Dianne Feinstein is always asking in the confirmation hearings. How do you feel about settled law? Of course, what she means is Roe v. Wade. And the answer, and Clarence Thomas has already given it in an absolutely stunning opinion called Stenberg v. Carrard, in which he says, how come nobody ever describes partial birth abortion, so-called? He says, because to describe it is to condemn it, because it is just plain infanticide. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay, now I am going to read into the record of the Supreme Court of the United States a delivery room nurse's description of a partial birth abortion. And this is family radio. I'm not going to repeat it. But it is murder.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just plain murder. And it's horrible. But the point is, whatever your views about abortion, whatever your views about infanticide, if we were to make it legal, it is not in the power of unelected judges to make that determination, right? It is with abortion, the question, unless you are a Catholic, which I'm not, the question always is, where do you draw the line, right? Do you draw it at viability? Do you draw it at heartbeat? But even the original Roe v. Wade decision admitted that somewhere there is a line that a decent society does not cross.
Yeah, you can't kill them once they're alive.
And
now they're all good with it.
Kill your 2-year-old. And by the way, and you can't kill your 2-hour-old. And you can't pull a living baby out of the womb and kill it when its feet are hanging out, which is what partial birth abortion is.
Right.
But it's not for the Supreme Court to draw that line. We live in a self-governing republic, and if we wish to criminalize things, then it needs to be the people's elected representatives who say what is legal and what is illegal, and it just becomes tyranny if you have unelected judges making up law out of whole cloth. And that is what the Warren Court brought in with a vengeance, and what the Supreme Court then did for decades afterwards, and what Clarence Thomas is working so hard to reverse, and is now, by the way, getting some traction in doing this, because, yes, the Supreme Court has been willing to overturn Supreme Court opinions, and that's something that, you know, you should see how terrified Justice Kagan and Justice Breyer are on this. I mean, they're just, they're shaking in their shoes because they can't see. And it's not, you understand, I mean, Justice Thomas, of course, you know, being a devout Catholic, feels very strongly that life begins at conception, plain and simple. And
yeah, because it does. Because after that, it becomes a person.
Okay, but just to stick on the constitutional issue, right? You know, the constitutional issue is, whatever your views about where to draw the line on this, you know, the United States Constitution does not give that power to 9 unelected justices, period. Mm-hmm. So that even if we were to agree that abortion in some form should be legal, it's not the Supreme Court's business to make that decision. It's the business of elected legislators to make that decision. And they could be wrong, but in any event, it's legitimate. Whereas when the Supreme Court is wrong, it has no legitimacy whatsoever. And that's the situation that we're in right now. So what?
Interesting, and you don't hear that very often. So we have to take one more really quick break here before the top of the hour. And, you know, we made fun of the guy at the Democratic Socialist Convention, so I had a song for all the women that were probably at the Socialist Convention, because I know how much they like to ride their bikes. So I thought maybe I should be an equal opportunity maligner, and so here's one for them. You're listening to We the People. Myra and I have always wanted to play Fat Bottom Girls, but I've never been able to work it into a show. So God love you for being on and just like giving me the open door.
Gee, let's not even go down that road, Aaron.
A step too far right there.
What? I figure we had all the comrades kind of, you know, twisting in the wind. We might as well just go all the way.
Oh, jeez. Watch out.
You got to watch those Queen songs that could go either way on you.
Yeah.
So what have we missed? What have we not
what
talked
we
about?
Missed. Not
What
not
do people need
really
to know about him that's like...
Not really much. I'll tell you, I think one thing that we need to know is that this recent... stay of an order to overturn the latest Trump administration attempt to rein in illegal immigration came from the Ninth Circuit Court
of Appeals. That's crazy, isn't it?
Well, now, you know, the Trump administration has now managed to confirm its 150th federal judge, and 20% of them are Clarence Thomas ex-clerks. So if you wonder, is Justice Thomas actually having an effect on our judiciary, there is proof positive. Did you ever think you would see the day when the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals would do something conservative?
No.
Sensible.
So it's a revolution.
Yeah, that blew my mind when that came down. I wonder what effect his policy of not taking referrals from the senators for those districts typically.
Oh, allowing them to.
Yeah.
Your blue slips. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And he said, "No, I don't need one," and he appointed his.
He's gonna move forward there.
Yeah, and I mean, look, these are customs, and you know, it's a funny kind of thing. This is a government with a written constitution, but yes, we also do have sort of Burkean traditions in our government, such as the one that George Washington set when he stepped down after two terms. And no one has presumed to overstep that except for Franklin Roosevelt. But that's not a law. That's, you know, or wasn't a law, right? It was just a tradition. Same with a nine-man Supreme Court or a nine-justice Supreme Court. There, it does not say in Article 3 how many judges there will be on the Supreme Court.
Wasn't there five? Originally,
yes.
Was it always nine?
Yes, and it grew over time, and so when FDR threatened to enlarge the court and pack it, he could do that. You know, I mean, nobody's quite sure of what the machinery would be, whether he could do it by fiat, but he did have control of Congress, so they could have simply passed a law saying the Supreme Court. You know, since Article 3 says that the judicial branch shall consist of a Supreme Court and such other courts as Congress may establish, well, it seems like you can, you know, the inference is that Congress could expand the Supreme Court to being, you know, as big as the UN and as diverse. So we do kind of live by these traditions too, and so there is a kind of, you know, there's a tension always.
Right.
There's a danger in this.
Right.
Well, I think most people don't know much about Clarence Thomas. Tell me this: how old is he? I forgot what you said when he was. When was he born?
How old is he? He is 71, I think. 71 or 72. Oh, wait a minute. He's 73.
Okay. So he's not...
Mm-hmm. No, he's young.
Yeah?
He's young.
Getting younger
and
every day from my perspective.
And he's peppy, and he's lost a lot of weight, and he stopped smoking cigars long ago, and, you know, he doesn't drink. So I mean he's doing great. I mean he's and you know, there have been all these rumors about the possibility of him retiring, and he just put paid to them a while ago and said, look, this is my calling, you know, this is my calling to bring back the Framers' Constitution, and I'm not going anywhere. So I think that, you know, I hope that he will be spared for many years. What he is doing and what he has been doing in now 28 years on the bench, 600 or 800 opinions, is just kind of laying out a blueprint for restoration of the Constitution of Liberty, patiently, 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 training all these clerks in the kind of jurisprudence that he sees to be appropriate and legitimate jurisprudence. And by the way, you know, teaching law school classes in Washington too. I mean, he's an active and busy guy, and it's starting to have fruit because you know, there is now this whole army out there of Clarence Thomas trained lawyers and Thomas trained judges. So that we have our blueprint for restoring the framers' constitution, and we have our troops who can carry it out. And if there were to be 4 more years of a Republican president, you know, it's possible that there would be yet another Supreme Court or another couple of Supreme Court vacancies, so that we actually could have a conservative Supreme Court for, you know, 40 years to come after this. And, you know, when I say a conservative Supreme Court, I do not mean a Supreme Court that has a conservative agenda, a conservative
right.
political agenda.
Because they can't have a political view. I mean, they.
Well, I mean, they, of course, everybody has.
Well, everybody
a political
does.
View.
But
yeah. But you can't, if you're a judge, you just have to say, what does the Constitution require? And that is a very, that is the question that a conservative judge asks. What does the Constitution, as the framers wrote it, require? A liberal or radical or lefty judge, I will not use the word progressive because there is nothing progressive,
there's nothing progressive about,
about
the
left, it. Right? Mm-hmm. But what he asks is, what is my policy choice and how can I rationalize it by some cockamamie interpretation of some precedent that we had 10 or 15 years ago? And that's how he argues, so that, you know, if you will just get limited government, if you want to have, you know, as the constitutional scholar Raoul Berger said, the people have the right to go to hell in their own way. If you don't believe that, you're not a Democrat. I mean, I get that. I get that. But
Myron,
it's the people who have to do it. The
exactly.
people, not the judges.
Yep. Good
we
point.
We thank you, Myron Magnet. You're a gentleman and a scholar. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And the book is Clarence Thomas
and
the
Lost Constitution. You can find that at WeThePeopleRadio.us. Everything about our guest and the recording of today's show.